Welcome to our first ever AMR Overtures discussion. My name is Joel St. Clair, and I'm the pastor of Mosaic Silver Spring in Silver Spring, Maryland, and an executive board member with AMR. Our goal, as we talked about in that first discussion that's linked below, is to foster a unified and faithful PCA. And one of the ways that we hope to do that is talking through the work of the General Assembly, what's often called overtures. That is requests for action or amendments that are sent up to the General Assembly, often or regularly by presbyteries. Today, we're going to take some time and talk through those overtures with David Coffin, with Fred Greco, and with Howie Donahoe. If you are interested in what these overtures are, there are a number of them. I should give you a heads up, but we've linked below to where you can find those overtures, as well as where there is a detailed guide that each of these men have written, and where it gives their reflections on these overtures and some greater feedback on them. And so we would just we're linking that below. We'd encourage you to take a look. In this second discussion, what we hope to focus on is what information should higher courts require or request from our sessions or from lower courts, particularly when it comes to things like review. So what kind of information should be sent up or turned in? And we're going to begin with Overture 8, which came from Nashville, where it is an amendment to BCO 24 that would really direct sessions when they have candidates for the office of ruling elder or for deacon that they would record their differences, their stated differences with the Westminster Standards. And this is a practice that happens at the presbytery level for any teaching elder, but this would extend that to sessions when it comes to ruling elders and to deacons as well. Now, in their respective guides, Howie Donahoe and David Coffin both suggested that we should answer this in the negative. Fred Greco recommended that we should answer in the affirmative as amended. And so, Fred, I'm going to invite you. Why do you think this change would be a helpful one for what's required of sessions?
I think, first of all, that this concept is already implicitly required in the book. But the reason that one of the reasons the BCO is in a three rings binder is me and Howie. I've authored five overtures this year. Howie, what do you have, three or four? We see problems or we see clarifications and we want to make it clear in the book. And so I think this will make clear that this is what sessions should do. Howie's guide makes clear that there's no mechanism for recording these differences. So that's what I think the amendment should be, to ask sessions to record it in their minutes. Now, why do I think this is the case? Well, there's two main arguments. The first is, according to our polity, ruling and teaching elders are of one office, two classes within one office. And so I think if teaching elders are going to state their differences to the standards, ruling elders should as well. I'm less enthusiastic or adamant about deacons, although I think in the examination of deacons in the average PCA church, those examinations themselves are less thorough and should be. They don't need the same level. Deacons aren't called to teach, so you don't need to have the same level of familiarity with all of the points of our standards. Secondly, I think this is already a part of our polity. There's actually the only case that I'm familiar with that specifically references a view that may not be held is Bowen versus Eastern Carolina, which was a ruling elder case, in which a ruling elder took a stated difference to infant baptism and limited atonement. And the General Assembly, through the SJC, said, you can't do that. You can't be ordained. They strike as hostile to the system. Now, that's not the most important difference with the standards, right? That's the only ones that have been adjudicated. And so I think it would be helpful for sessions to go through the exercise of, you know, asking men if they have a stated difference. Now, again, I don't think this needs to be some kind of massive inquiry. That doesn't mean you need to complete a 50-page questionnaire or get, you know, grilled on every minute point of doctrine. But there are men by conscience that take differences with the standards. And I think for the man's sake, we should allow him to express those differences so that he can take the vow. I don't really see what the real problem is for this. I don't see this as being a significant issue. I think it's already a part of our polity.
Yeah. Thank you, Fred, for giving us your sense of maybe the slight change in terms of where to record, but why it's worthwhile to move forward. Howie, David, would you like to respond with thoughts?
Well, just with the story, I mean, I've done this every time I've gone to a church when I've been considered as an elder. I give them, I won't tell you how many pages there are, but I've given them my confessional differences. But I remember in a large church in the Southeast, I'll just say that, I was being examined to be, I was already ordained an elder. I was being examined to go on the session. I had given that document to the three guys that were going to examine me. I walked in the room and they looked like they had seen a ghost. And I said, "What's up?" And they said, "Well, what's this thing?" And I said, "Those are my differences." "What do you mean those are your differences?" I said, "What do you mean? What do you mean? What are the?" Anyway, they said no one in 18 years had ever expressed any difference with anything in the Westminster standards. And I thought, okay, well, that seems weird, but the longer I've been in the PCA, the more often I see that in exams. It's like, no differences, no difference. Okay. I mean, maybe I'm a weird dude, but so, I mean, I have done this every time. When we examine a guy to be an elder, we ask him, have you read it? What do you think? So, but something tells me I don't like it. I don't know. I'll be honest. I don't know.
Yeah, just for viewers, we're not making a determination on whether it's weird to have stated differences or not have stated differences. We're just thankful for everyone who reflects on the standards, reads them thoroughly, and then records, if they find anything that's different.
Yeah, I meant no disparagement. Sorry.
No, just I didn't think you did. I just want to make that all crystal right. Clear. David, do you have any thoughts on Overture 8?
Well, my concerns there are not really relevant in a sense. I think the language that is currently used for ministers is seriously misguided. The idea of striking at the vitals of religion, for example, that language. Historically, that language means the essential doctrines of Christianity, has nothing to do with the essential elements of the standards. And I think it was foolish for us to ever put that in there. It was from a very obscure place in the rules of discipline. And I don't think it functions well in the chapter where it's found, and I just soon not see it in chapter 24 either. So that's the reason for my objection.
So is your concern strikes at the vitals of religion or contrary to a fundamental of the system of doctrine? Those are two different animals, but it sounds like you're saying you don't like the second animal.
I don't like either of them.
Okay.
If you say fundamentals of the system of doctrine, I mean, Warfield thought every chapter was fundamental to the system of doctrine. That is not a helpful category. So it's ahistorical. I don't think it makes any rational sense. And I actually had a very fine substitute motion for that in the Bills and Overtures Committee that year, but the committee decided that if a substitute motion didn't forward the view of the overture itself, it was out of order.
Bills and Overtures is what Overtures Committee used to be called. What year did it change from Bills and Overtures to Overtures? Anybody know?
When
the same year they got rid of the Yellow Pages.
And for our most newly ordained or people to the PC who are watching, the three-ring binder used to be the exclusive way in which you would receive your BCO. Now, being able to download it from the AC website by PDF is probably used more typical. Fred, is there a way to distinguish if someone has a blue three-ring binder that they're using as opposed to scrolling on some electronic device versus like a leather-bound version of the three-ring binder? Does that say something about those
I do
respective
have a
people?
leather-bound version. Yeah, that's right. I do. No, but I think we are changing this. I don't think we're going to change this provision. I have sympathy with what David's saying, but as kind of a practical ex-lawyer, that ship has sailed and landed in port, and they got on a horse and went down into the barn. That's never going to get changed. This language we have, now about strikes at the vitals or fundamentals. And so I just like to see it brought in alignment. If we could go back in a time machine with David, I think I might come up with a better solution, or David could give us a better solution. I don't see that happening though, and I don't see that being a fruitful effort at this point. So while I appreciate, David's disagreement with that, it seems to me if that's where we are and what we have, my main point would be that we should treat ruling elders the same way we treat teaching elders.
Let me say, we do New Hope. We precisely did that, and have done even before this change in language. We had them say where they disagreed, and I think that it ought to be just as carefully done for the deacons myself, whether that they are. How's it going there to be competent in sound doctrine or something that? In the Titus passage. I mean, and they have, in fact, a critical governmental task. That's why I always think it's odd that, I mean, what was their task in Acts 6? It was to adjudicate the fair distribution of the church's goods to members. That's an authority that requires careful discernment and certainly to be a person who's rooted in sound doctrine. I don't think they're just the guys that mow the lawn or put up the chairs.
I want to take maybe a little difference there. I mean, I agree with the role that they had. I'm not sure the guy's view on infant baptism renders his discernment on how to distribute the goods has too much effect on that. I don't want to get in that discussion, and we don't have, deacons that don't believe in infant baptism, but I'm not entirely sure. My theological bar is lower than yours for deacons, I guess.
Well, it goes to a root debate that we're not taking up as part of our time, which is what is not only the role of deacons relative to elders, but then what authority do they have? And so, what do you need to test or examine before you would ordain such a person to those roles? Right. And that I think that's a fair debate. It's an open question on the biblical theological development from Acts 6 through to 1 Timothy 3 and Titus 1, but we're not going to take that up today. So that it's helpful just to kind of hear at least from each of you, not only how you respond, say negative or affirmative, but what's underneath of that, because sometimes it's different. And it sounds like it's different from each of you for different reasons, which is, I hope, a challenge to those who are showing up to the 52nd General Assembly to kind of think through what is it that's being proposed and then how you understand and interpret that. So next up, we have Overture 34 from Savannah River. And this overture is not a proposed amendment to the BCO, but a proposed amendment to the RAO, which stands for Rules of Assembly Operation. And one thing worth noting is depending on what happens in the overtures committee itself, these have a different voting pathway. So amendments to the BCO, if approved by overtures and then by the assembly, they are sent down to all of the presbyteries for a required two-thirds vote. But if it's a proposed amendment to the RAO, the rules of assembly operation, then if it is taken up or approved by the overtures committee, then that's sent to the assembly itself for approval. So that particular assembly would take it up, and then it would require a two-thirds vote of that particular assembly. If passed, it goes into effect immediately. And so I just want to highlight this is the first RAO change we're taking up. We've been talking about BCO changes up to this point. Overture 34 from Savannah River is to amend the RAO, particularly Chapter 16, to require reporting on session and diaconate membership and duties. And so in looking at the various thoughts or reflections on 34, I'm going to invite Fred just to respond in as much as David and Howie, you were both negatives on this. Fred, you were an affirmative on this. Why did you think this was a helpful change to the RAO, Fred?
I guess the first thing I have to say, and I put it in my comments, I'm not sure the RAO is a place to put this. I realize that it's easier to amend the RAO, but it seems to me that this should probably be in the BCO, because I think what this is getting at is there is a movement or a tendency in our denomination for churches to not ordain men to the diaconate, because they don't want to have a solely male diaconate. And so they found a loophole, and that's not ordain anyone and have a mercy team. I don't think that's biblical or proper. I think what our BCO says is if you don't have deacons, your elders are to do that work. That's Allah Acts 6. I think also if you have women to be involved in the work of mercy and necessity, you should, as a church, and you can have a mercy team. And a church that doesn't have women involved in diaconal ministry broadly is in real trouble. They can't minister, I think, properly to the whole of the congregation. And so I think it would be helpful for us to understand, are there churches like a new church or a church plant that doesn't have enough men to do this, or their two deacons moved away or not? I think there should be a sense in which every functioning, healthy church should have a session of at least two men and probably a diaconate of at least one or two men. And if they don't have a diaconate, they should be able to give a reason why. So, I don't know what the language would exactly be. Again, this might be something I tinker with in the next week and offer some amendments, because I do think the BCO is the better place for it to go.
And is that
Those are
just
my
to ask,
thoughts.
is that because, say, the BCO is already addressing certain situations about not only the role of the deacon in chapter 9, but also, as you alluded to, kind of what would happen in the church if you didn't have deacons? These kinds of various scenarios are already articulated in the BCO itself. So to jump over to the RAO for an amendment, is that that's am I understanding correctly?
And the RAO is really a reporting requirement. It doesn't get to the substance of it. And so I don't know why you would start with a reporting requirement without having a BCO requirement. You know, maybe what you'd do is you'd make some kind of BCO amendment, and then if you wanted a reporting requirement, then you could go to do the RAO. But I don't really see why you start with the reporting requirement. I think this is more fundamental to the office of elder, the office of deacon, and ordination per se.
Any thoughts about that, David?
I agree entirely with Fred that it doesn't belong in the RAO in the first instance. I'll say two things quickly. One, I have written a paper that I think demonstrably shows that right now the law of the church is that every congregation must have the opportunity for qualified men to become deacons. And if they're not doing so, they're violating the Constitution of the church. So I think it's demonstrably the case now, and thus I don't think this is needed. Second, though, it strikes me as just a little Orwellian that we have a proposition that on the face of it is just collecting statistics, but it underlying is for the purpose of discovering criminality. I just don't like the smell of this thing.
Just to ask, my understanding is there's been also SJC case law on this, or cases that have articulated when it's not acceptable to refuse ordination to a man in a church who's otherwise qualified or put forward. It would violate our standards to refuse them ordination on some other principle. I think we would all agree on that. It seems to be how this has been articulated, and then what the SJC cases rulings have been. Am I understanding that properly? Am I missing
I think
something?
we have so ruled, yeah.
My memory doesn't serve me. There was a Northwest Georgia case about a guy that wanted to be a deacon, but I'm not sure it's precisely what you're saying. I agree
Yeah,
with
I think I
the
was touching on from California the various views on the diaconate, right? That this has come up a few different times through California and possibly through Philadelphia. We not that it's going
Philadelphia
to
is
be
what I
here,
heard.
but this question, it's not a new one to the denomination through its history on who and how people can participate, how those things should be titled or framed, and how to think about it. But it
Yeah.
seems to be accepted that if there's qualified candidates for ordination in any pathway, that the congregation would have access or a route to put those qualified people forward and to vote on them. Orwellian, George Orwell wrote 1984, reference to totalitarian antics. The idea that you would come up with alternative ways to sniff out bad things going on. All right, Howie, go.
No, I won't use such a draconian term, but it seems to me if someone believes, as Fred was saying, that you have to have an ordained diaconate, then specifically write an overture that mandates that and let the PCA vote on that. This is like, well, okay, let's collect data for a future overture or something. No, write it now. So.
One of the things that I wanted to note is because I think it's rising up in the conversation, there's often quite a bit of agreement among you three for differing reasons on various overtures or issues before the court. So, in your reflective writings on all of the overtures, you agreed on overtures 6, 7, 10, 11, 13, 14, 15, 16, 19, 22, 23, 25, 27, 28, 31, 32, 33, 35, 37, 40, and the six change in presbytery boundaries that are referred to M&A.
We agreed
That's
on
the,
all that.
that makes me
yeah,
tired
that's,
just hearing that.
and that's more, that's more than half.
I'm gonna have to go back and revise some of mine.
So that's like 26 out of the 50, and one of those are vacated. So it's really like 26 out of the 49 for varying reasons, not always the same reasons. You answered the same in terms of how you individually would vote on these things. I just want to highlight that because if someone's watching this, they're like, oh, they're only picking on the things that maybe there's a bit of a rub or some disagreement. But even in that disagreement, there's a lot of unity in terms of how you're approaching these things or the seriousness or weight that you're giving them. So thanks, and I think it's just worth highlighting for whoever is listening or watching. Okay, there is a set of three overtures from from Calvary Presbytery, which is in South Carolina. So these three overtures came up one right after the other. They were probably submitted as a package, so they just get ordered. It's oftentimes how these overtures are numbered. That's just the order in which they're received by the stated clerk's office. And so you'll see overtures 41, 42, and 43. Collecting and reporting on worship times, not collecting on age and ethnicity, and then an RAO change regarding age and ethnicity. So these are effectively three things about kind of how we collect data or the function of that. I'm going to invite Howie to kick us off. Thoughts on these three? You can take them one at a time. You can talk about them
Yeah, no, I
collectively.
sure. The idea of collecting and reporting worship times, two comments real quick. I think it's very inefficient because if the clerk's office collected that and put it on the website, 20% of them would be inaccurate because they're not updated. So if I'm in Milwaukee and I need to find a PCA church, it's pretty easy to find and their times are updated. So it You know, part of me wonders, well, is that a way to do research on who doesn't have evening service or something? I don't know. It just seems odd. The thing about collecting data on age and ethnicity, that one I just couldn't figure out exactly where the energy was. And the thing that, I mean, there were some whereases that talked about the church is just covenant keepers or covenant breakers, or, I don't know. But it just dawned on me, we got nine Korean presbyteries with 240 plus Korean churches with 700 plus Korean ministers that are 14% of the PCA. That's a pretty ethnic thing. I mean, would you, do we pretend that that doesn't exist? It just seemed, that part of it seemed odd to me. That's all.
So my answer, Joel, would be very boring. It's all about time and effort. If the clerk puts on the form that comes to us, put your service times, that takes my secretary 30 seconds to fill that out. My congregation has more than 25 nations represented. And I'm not going to ask one family that's African American and Venezuelan what I should put them down as and what I should put their kids down as. Maybe that's not true of every place in the PCA. Houston's the most diverse city in the world, according to a Rice study. If that's on the form, I'm not filling it out. And I think the reason it came up was because the stated clerk announced that they were going to put that on the form and they were going to collect it. I don't have a lot of passion about either of these because all of this is optional. Maybe I could make a germane amendment if Howie and David are with me to do something to get churches to fill out the report. So we have more than
Amen.
half the churches fill it out. Maybe we give them a 50 buck break on registration or something. The truth of the matter is we don't really know what the PCA looks like because half the churches don't fill out the report.
Right.
And I
Yeah.
would love to see effort put there, just to be blunt.
Yeah, just to be clear for those who are watching, because everyone on this call or understands the way in which we report things like statistics right now, there's no mandatory mechanism for that. What happens is once a year, the stated clerk's office sends out a request either online or by paper. You can fill it out. Someone at the church, one copy goes to the stated clerk of every church, one copy goes to the pastor of that church. And then all of that data is collected that now Howie is holding up for you for the last yearbook. It gets all collected. But if you look through that yearbook, you don't have to look hard. There's churches we know are particularized by the record that are listed in a fill-in-the-blank presbytery. And so you can see them, but then it'll have what year they last reported. Oftentimes it's not recent. And then they'll have, or they'll have all blanks all the way across, meaning they haven't reported. And, so what's being discussed is, well, this is all voluntary, which means, when we think about church growth as a denomination, is the denomination growing numerically? And in what ways is it growing? In what areas is it growing? What presbytery, which of the 87 are we seeing growth or not? Where are we struggling or is just difficult work? All of those things are voluntary right now, meaning every church has the ability to fill it out or not. And if a church decides at some point that they want to adjust their roles and then report it, that actually can create swings, almost what you would call like noise in the data, because it's like, oh, whoa, what happened there? It wasn't the redo of Acts where 3,000 are baptized. It was someone adjusted their roles for the first time in a number of years, right? So voluntary, you'd like to see incentives set up to maybe encourage that. Not necessarily make it mandatory, but at least incentivize it. Okay.
Exactly.
On go ahead, David. On 42 and 43, I would commend to you the administrative committee's report. A lot of times folks don't bother to read those, but I think their answer as to the usefulness of the data and how they're doing it and why in the AC report was very, very helpful.
Thanks so much. I can link that. So he's talking about the administrative committee turns in a report for this GA. So it's in your commissioner's handbook for this GA. And if you just scan down, they'll give response to that. It was directed to them for 42, and 43 was both overtures as well as AC because it's the REO change. Okay. Anything else on this grouping? So that covered overtures 8, 34, 41, 42, and 43. Thanks so much for your thoughts, for your comments, for your gracious interaction. We're grateful for you joining us today, and we hope to see you at General Assembly.